Hello and welcome to Homestead Hens and Honey, a beekeeping, chicken keeping, and general homesteading podcast. I'm your host, Gemma, and today I am talking about baby season here on the homestead. That includes reptiles and chickens, which is kind of appropriate if you think about how closely related they are. And I'll also give a little brief update on how my package of bees is doing since the install. Last week I had to skip an episode, which I apologize again for. I appreciate everyone's patience with me. The last 2 weeks or so have just been so busy, I couldn't squeeze in any time to record. I know in my previous episode I mentioned that we'd had a ceiling leak, and we'd had a plumber out and it seemed like an easy fix, but he did warn me that it might end up being more involved, and sure enough, it was. So I was scheduling more work being done on that. On top of that issue, my husband was doing animal surgery with his graduate students for 2 weeks, which gives him a very restricted schedule. He needs to be in early and then he's there as long as it takes. So if the animal takes a long time to go under or a long time to revive, then that's just how it is. And since we're a one-car household, that impacts my ability to get things done because I'm usually the one driving. And usually I could just let him have the car, but it just so happened that I had a ton of doctors and vet appointments scheduled that I really didn't want to have to reschedule because it was hard enough to get them done in the first place, including my routine breast MRI, which was all good, by the way. But that's like basically my day gone because they give me Xanax due to my claustrophobia, and you know, I can't really do anything after that. So that took up, you know, a good day. And then I've had the baby skinks, which require, you know, a lot of cleaning and feeding and contacting buyers and getting photos and videos for the website. And then on top of that, we've had sort of an on and off septic issue. It just seemed like maybe a minor block somewhere in the pipes outside. I finally managed to get someone over to look at it, and that's going to be a whole big thing. They're actually coming out tomorrow. They have to dig out one of the tanks to check something. And either we're looking at a minor excavation and then like snaking and some other stuff, which is going to be expensive, but, you know, not super expensive. And then we'll probably get a couple of extra years on the system, or the whole system's going to have to be replaced, which is hugely expensive and not really something that we want to do. But it turns out that the septic is actually way older than we thought it was, and it's very possible that we're going to have to replace it within the next couple of years, regardless of what they find. So really the issue is this something that has to be done imminently, or is this something that we can kind of kick the can down the road? Because that kind of expense is going to take some planning. And then while all of this is going on, my husband had arranged to host a barbecue for his graduate students. One has recently graduated and she's going off to do her postdoc. And it was kind of a celebration of her graduation and also something that we do just to kind of touch base with all of his students and, you know, help them be a cohesive lab and all that kind of good stuff. And so this meant a lot of work for me because he's doing animal surgery, so is busy all day, every day. And I'm just way too house proud to not like deep clean the house and get all the lawns mowed and tidy up anything that I feel is too visible, like the front garden beds, and generally just running around and trying to get all this stuff done, including like buying and prepping food and getting drinks and just all this sort of stuff on top of all the appointments and on top of animal chores that take up half my day anyway, and on top of swimming, because that's my self-care and I refuse to not be able to do it. So I still managed to squeeze in 3 swims a week. So yes, that's why I didn't record. It was just way too much stuff going on, and I really just didn't have a second. And honestly, when I did have a second, I was usually lying down covered in puppies, just enjoying being still for 5 minutes. On the plus side, the minute the barbecue was done, I was able to sort of run outside into the garden and get some more fun things done. So I finally have my corn and my squash seeds planted. The cucumber and the sunflowers that I planted before are just starting to sprout, and you can see the first sort of tender leaves coming up above the soil, which is very exciting. This weekend, I'm hoping that I can get down to my local plant nursery and pick up tomatoes, peppers, and then herb plants this weekend. That would be good. Bloody hell, sorry, I had to run off. I don't know if this edit is going to be kind of jarring. I can see into the garden from where I'm recording, and I could see that the whippets were really, really into something that made me very, very concerned. So I had to run out there and just make sure that they weren't like harassing a garter snake or a family of toads or rabbits or something. Instead, they were just being disgusting little monsters and eating poo, which is just, why do this, babies? Anyway, okay, so things have been mad, but I got out into the garden, I got stuff done. The one thing that I can't kind of get off my to-do list just yet is my side bed, the one that I had landscaped. The weeds are kind of getting out of hand again because we've had some really glorious weather. And it's just one of those things where I've had to prioritize other things. And so I can't get out there. And I keep setting aside the time and saying, okay, this is the day. I'm going to just be out there for 2 hours and weed. And then I get distracted or something comes up. Tuesday was going to be my big day. It was my first day all to myself with nothing scheduled. And instead, I got this weird compulsion to clean and organize my garage. So I got about 60% of that utter disaster like sorted and cleaned and organized so that I kind of know where things are, which is long overdue. The remaining 40% I can't do. There's a lot of stuff on one side of the garage that's very, very heavy. And because of my back issues, I didn't want to risk moving them. As it was, I was already kind of sore from what I did haul around that day. But I got to admit, it feels good that every time I go back out there, I'm really, really impressed. Like the floor is so clean and everything is in its place and I know where things are. So it's not as if it wasn't worth it. It's just frustrating. I've already had one neighbor kindly offer to share stuff with me to get the weeding done, which is their kind of polite way of letting me know that it's bothering them, which always makes me feel kind of shitty, but what am I going to do? I'll get to it when I get to it. So I said this would be about baby season, so let's talk babies. So first things first, my baby skinks that I've been talking about, well, my first litter is ready to go. I've actually sold my first baby and that one is shipping out next week. I'm trying to sell a couple of others so I can just get a couple of shipments done all at once. It's much more convenient. Looking at my remaining two females, I don't think Europa took. I don't think she's pregnant, which is a big bummer because this will be her third year of not producing anything. And she is my favorite female. So some of it is because she is from my very first pink tongue skink, Dione, who I sadly lost unexpectedly. And so I just have a huge soft spot for her, but she's also really, really big for a pink tongue. And she just gives the most beautiful big babies. So it's sad that I don't have any from her again. And it's also sad because it means that her mate, Titan's hemipenal abscess, which as a reminder, the hemipenes are the male sexual organ in reptiles. They have two of them. He had an abscess. We did treat it. There has been some scar tissue left over. And this was my year where if Europa didn't get pregnant, I would know that he is unable to fertilize her now with whatever is left, whether it's from the scar tissue or whatever. And it's sad for me because I really like them as a pair. They're very gentle together. They produce really beautiful babies. And also because it means I'm going to have to retire him as a male. I actually have a possible home in sort of a interesting twist of or turn of fate. I was reached out to someone reached out to me who had bought a baby skink from someone else, and it was really aggressive and wasn't taming. And this is very, very unusual for this species. And I did kind of wonder if maybe it was just bluffing, you know, acting tough, but not following through. And they sent me video, and I've never seen anything like this from a pink tongue. I mean, this is an actively aggressive pink tongue. I've never seen of it, never heard of it before, never experienced it. Even my nastiest baby started calming down by the time it was 6 months. And this one is 8 months, I believe. And it's like this, and it bites her and it's drawn blood. And so she's going to return it. And she really wants a calm, easy to handle skink. And Titan would be perfect. He is so docile and so gentle. Also, he's an adult, so his temperament isn't going to change at this point. And now that he is either infertile or if the odds just are against him because he only has one functioning hemipene, I don't need him as a breeder. And retiring males takes up more space because you can only keep one male in a tank at a time. And I'm actually considering retiring Pandora, my female, one of my females who bred for me this year. I just feel like her recovery is taking a little longer each litter, and I'm worried that it's just too hard on her. And if I retire my females, I can keep females in a group. They won't fight the way males do. So if I have a retirement tank, I would rather that would be for my females that are either retired or resting, because I like to make sure that if a female bred 1 year, she's not bred the next year. I just think it's too much for them. So since I'm not like hugely sentimentally attached to Titan, he's not one I produced, although he has been a very, very good male. I actually was thinking maybe he'd be a good fit for her. We're just waiting right now because I promised her video of me handling him so she can really see how gentle he is. And also, I'm just going to get his scar tissue where the hemipenal abscess was. I just want to get it double checked by my vet before I sell him. It would be awful if he went to a new home and then cost them hundreds and hundreds of dollars in vet bills. So I really want to make sure that he's in really good health, and the remaining lump that you can see there is just scar tissue. I suspect very strongly it is because his appetite's great. He's active. He did try and mate. He just wasn't successful. So I'm kind of excited about that. I feel like it's a good fit, and it makes me happy to know that he's going to someone who really just wants a really calm skink to spend time with and hang out with, and that's exactly what he needs, and I think that's a really good retirement for him. In terms of my other female that I've been waiting on, Io, she passed two slugs on Tuesday, and slugs are unfertilized eggs that start to enlarge and then they just kind of pass them because they don't develop into anything, right? So she passed two of those on Tuesday, and I really thought she was going into labor, and then nothing since. And so I'm starting to worry a little bit that she's going to slug out, as we call it, which is basically that she got big as if she was pregnant, but nothing really took, and she's just going to pass all of the ova. This isn't completely uncommon for a first-time breeder. It happened, you know, but it's a big... Pregnancy is very draining on the body, regardless of what kind of animal you are. So it's possible. I'm not 100% though, because she's not eating. And that is a good sign that she's pregnant, because if they were all unfertilized, if she was just filled with slugs, she wouldn't be as full as if she had babies in there, because they're live birthers. So I'm kind of cautiously optimistic that I might see a litter from her. I would love to see what she produces. I paired her with Hyperion, who's my male from my very original pairing of Dione and Ganymede, both of which have now passed away, but they're what started my business. I love Hyperion. He's a really big, beautiful male, and she did really well with him. He couldn't be as rough with her as he was with the smaller females, because she's a pretty big girl herself, and I think they're going to produce beautiful babies together. So really hoping that even if she just passes, I don't know, maybe she'll just have like four or something, but that would be delightful. So if everyone can keep their fingers crossed, that would be great. In the episode description of my last episode, I mentioned that right after I finished recording, I went out to check on all my chickens, and Dahlia's had hatched one of the eggs, and it was a little yellow baby. And that yellow baby is now getting some reddy brown markings on her wings and back. And I'm starting to wonder if maybe she's not an Orpington, if she's one of the ginger girls that I have. I suspect that the ginger girls are ISA browns, or ISA browns as I call them. But I don't know for sure, because one was given to me, and then the other one is from a mixed flock where a lot of them were just sort of barnyard mutts. So she might not be a purebred of any kind. Not that it matters, but it just means that I don't know what their chicks look like. But it's a very cute little chick. Dahlia is being a very good mummy, except for one thing. So in hindsight, I realized that I messed up how I moved eggs for her. So I left too much time between giving her each egg that I added to her clutch. And so as a result, this chick hatched first, and the others still needed, I think it was at least 4 days of incubation. But the chick became active within that time, and so Dahlia was abandoning the nest because she needs to be with her chick. And so for a while, I was just sort of, she was hanging out in the run a lot with the chick, and she was still kind of settling down a lot because, you know, the baby can't manage its own temperature yet. So between like her showing it where to eat and drink, she would just settle down and the baby would snuggle under her. And so I was moving the eggs from the nest box underneath her, but obviously she would eventually move again and then go into the nest box at night. And so it was a lot of moving eggs around, and I was worried. And I did candle them, and there's definitely, you know, almost fully developed babies in there. So my options were let them die or incubate them. And I think you all know where this is going. I talked to my husband, and we have various incubators, some of which my husband made, for snake eggs. So I go up to the reptile room to kind of dig through what we have, and to my delight, we still have an old Hoverbaiter, which is a incubator that's originally designed for poultry eggs, so chickens and ducks and turkeys. And we have it because it was the first one that we tried when incubating snake eggs. We found that it wasn't super effective for the species of snakes that we were raising, and so we've just had it sort of on standby. But obviously it's perfect for chicken eggs. So I was delighted. I made sure it was working, cleared it out, you know, got everything set up. And the good news was, because they were far along in their development, I didn't need to turn the eggs. So when chicken eggs are being incubated, the mother turns them. But if you have them in an incubator yourself, you need to turn them. The nice thing about a Hoverbaiter is it is made so you can put an automatic turner in the bottom. We don't have that because you don't need that for snakes. In fact, You don't want to move the eggs for snakes at all. It's very important that you don't jostle them or shift their position. So I didn't have to worry about that. So I popped 4 eggs into the incubator and, oh my goodness, it's the definition of a watched pot never boils. I could not stop checking on those eggs. I mean, I wasn't opening the incubator every time, but I've got like a flashlight and I'm peering through the little window on the top constantly to see if there's movement or like a little crack or whatever. And finally, when the first baby pipped, I was so excited because I'm thinking, okay, it's pipped. It's going to be out any second. No, it took the whole day to hatch. And I, obviously, as I always do, I went back to my books and the books are just like, yeah, you know, they pip and that takes a huge amount of energy. And it's usually a good couple of hours where they rest after breaking through their shell before they finish the process because it's just exhausting. So I had to be patient and I actually was very fortunate because I was there when the baby fully hatched. It was so cute. This big, wet, ugly baby hatched, and the way that it kind of popped out of the egg, I don't know if this is the way they all do, but the way this baby did is it kind of fell out backwards. So one half of the egg, it kind of kicked off with its feet, and the other half of the egg sort of got underneath its body, and it just sort of flopped backwards dramatically and then just started peeping so loudly before just conking out with exhaustion. It was really adorable. So that was my first baby that I've ever had in an incubator for poultry. And it took a little while for it to dry up. And everything I read was basically like, do not open the incubator until the chick is dry. So it was very hard to wait. And as it turned out, the baby was still in there drying off during the barbecue that we hosted. And so people had a great time seeing the skink babies and then the freshly hatched chick. And on top of that, my husband has his babies from last season. They're still small. And so everyone got to see those as well. Those are baby snakes, by the way. So that was really fun. And then again, like proving that I timed everything badly, it took a couple of days before the next egg pipped. That baby popped out much faster. Apparently that one was much more eager to greet the world. So within a couple of hours, it was out. And then finally, some days after that, the third baby came out. And the third baby is currently my favorite. And the reason why is, so the first two babies, they're clearly Orpingtons. They have huge feet and they are black and white. And they have white markings on their face that actually helps me tell them apart. Because at first, you know, one was obviously bigger than the other, but that's kind of evening out now. So I don't know if they're going to be black Orpingtons or if they're going to be silver or if they might even do what Red did, where she was really dark when she was born, but then she got more and more red. I don't know. But this third baby, the first thing I notice is that its comb is much bigger than the others. So I don't know if that means already that I have a rooster, but I think it's interesting. And also the Orpington chicks have big feet that are pink and black, like pink toes and black legs. And this baby has solid sort of grey black legs. His colouring is also more grey-black, and he has very little white on him. So I don't know if he's going to be like just a different coloured Orpington, or if he might be from one of the other hens. I grabbed the eggs that I was pretty sure were Orpington eggs, but I have a sort of generic black chicken, I don't know what her breed is, that it could be from the Ginger Girls, it could be from them. Theoretically, it could even be from a Well Summer, but I'm pretty sure those babies look a lot different. But anyway, so this one's my favorite. I'm really curious to see how it develops. And then I have one egg left that I'm kind of 50-50 on. It's either really, really behind all the others, or it's stopped developing and it hasn't decayed to show. All the photos I saw of eggs that stop developing partway through, there's this red ring that becomes visible between where the embryo is and where the air sac is, or air bubble. And I'm not seeing that hard red line. It just looks like a healthy egg. It doesn't smell as... I think it's possible it's still okay and it's just behind. So we have it in the incubator. It will stay there at the appropriate temperatures and humidity until I know what's going on with it. My only concern is that if it's this far behind, I haven't been turning it. So everything that you read or that I've read basically says once you get to like day 15, and it usually takes about 21 days to hatch, you don't turn it anymore. Well, I haven't been turning it for longer than that. So I don't know. I'm a little concerned, but we'll see. Again, it's just my first time. I think what I should have been more cognizant of is that if I had Dahlia in the big flock instead of separated in her tiny flock, what would happen is that when she goes broody, she would let the other hens lay, and then she would sit back on them, and then she'd move again for them to lay, and she'd let the other hens contribute to her clutch until she had the amount that I guess feels right to her. And then she starts to dedicatedly sit on those eggs, thereby beginning incubation. And this is why a clutch tends to hatch within 24 hours of each other. So generally speaking, they all hatch at the same time or very, very closely. What I did was I was taking an egg here or there and shoving it under her when she was already sitting. So I started the incubation for each egg at a different time. And now that I know that this is what causes a problem, I will, next time she goes broody, collect all the eggs in one day, put them all under her at the same time, or at the very least, put most of them under her on day one and then the rest on day two, so that hopefully we won't have this situation where a chick hatches and becomes active, requiring her to leave the nest. Okay, so that's where I am with the chicks. I will say my only minor disappointment is unless this fourth egg does hatch and prove me wrong, I don't think I got a Fanny egg. Fanny is my Lavender Orpington, who I just think is the most beautiful chicken in the world. And I really, really want to get babies from her. And I don't think any of these are lavenders, which is kind of a bummer. But I can try again, probably next year, because I think my husband's nervous that I'm not going to get rid of these chicks. I think he's worried about how many chickens we're getting. I did have a chicken math issue last year, so that's probably why. Okay, so considering this is my first time with raising chicks in the house, and it's something I said I would never do, I did have to scramble a little bit to make sure I had everything that was needed. So I was fortunate that we had the incubator. Once they're out of the incubator, they need to go into a brooder. And fortunately for my chicks, because we have so many reptiles, I had a 15-gallon tank that would be perfect for them, as well as a ceramic heat bulb, which would get the temperature high enough for the newborn chicks or the newly hatched chicks. I already had probiotics and electrolytes to add to the water for Dahlia's chick, and then I had chick feed and chick grit. But I wanted to make sure that I was doing everything correctly. So I looked on my bookshelf of chicken books and I ended up using Fresh Eggs Daily by Lisa Steele. I love this book. It's beautiful. The photographs are incredible. It has a really great flow and layout. And it's very succinct as well. So if you need information on something specific, you can get the details that you need, but it doesn't take you paragraphs and paragraphs to dig that out. So she has a whole chapter 12, about brooding or the brooder. And she recommends, you know, what you can use, what kind of substrate you want. So you want to wait on using shavings for a while because they can be a little dusty. So you kind of want paper towels or shelf liner, something that's not slippery. And then the big thing is the temperature. And what I love, and I'm going to try and get a photo to put on my Instagram, is she has a rule of thumb temperature chart, which is just the perfect summation of what you need to know. So during the first week of your chick's life, you need to keep the warm side of the enclosure at 95 degrees Fahrenheit. That's why I'm using a ceramic heat bulb. They can produce a lot of heat, more than a like a light bulb would. And also remember that that's a constant heat. So it's not just like having that temperature on during the day. That needs to be 24/7. And the bonus of the ceramic heat bulb is it doesn't emit light. So it's not going to be messing up with their circadian rhythms by shining down on them when it's bedtime. So first week, it's 95 degrees Fahrenheit. And then every week after, you drop it by 5 degrees. So the second week is 90, third week is 85, fourth week is 80, fifth week is 75, sixth week is 70. And then once you're around this time, that's sort of hopefully your daytime temperatures, and you can start thinking about moving them into an outside enclosure as long as the evening temperatures aren't too cold. She also mentions that if you have day temperatures that are warm enough within those guidelines, you can take them out to experience some outside time. If you monitor them, make sure they don't get too cold before you bring them back in. She also talks about things to look out for, like you don't want a big bowl of water because they can drown in it. So you need either an appropriate chick waterer, or you need a very shallow dish with pebbles or marbles or something in it that the chick can brace itself on if it falls in. She talks about food, herbs that you can give them that can be beneficial, and weeds and stuff that when you can start feeding it, what size it needs to be. Preventing B2 deficiency, which can be a big issue for some chicks, although hopefully your feed should be appropriate, but she gives some recommendations of things you can add. And it's just really helpful. So I just love it. I have the book right in front of me, if you can hear the pages turning. Pictures are great. Like I said, just perfect. It was exactly what I needed. I think what I'll be doing this weekend is moving them into a larger tank. So I have them in a 15 gallon right now. I'm going to be moving them into something much, much bigger because I need to get the heat element further away from them to allow the temperatures inside to drop by 5 degrees each week. And also because they're going to start growing really fast and I want to make sure that they're not cramped. And also because that way they have a larger area so they can get closer or further away from the heat source, so they have a bigger temperature gradient. And yeah, that's kind of it. So that's where I am right now. Maybe by the time I record next week, I'll know what's going on with my last egg. Like I said, I'm hopeful that it's just behind. Hopefully it is not dead. I did mention in my title that I would give a quick update on my package of bees that I installed. So as a reminder, it was a 3-pound package of bees with a new Carniolan queen. I had the queen marked. The colour for this year is hot pink, apparently. So that looks very pretty and it's very easy to see. So I'd been in to make sure she was released, and they had released her. And at that time, it was only 3 or 4 days after I'd installed them, and there were no signs of eggs. And that worried me a little bit because the queen was small as well. And I don't know, this past winter, losing all of my colonies the way I did really shook me. And so I keep thinking that everything's going to go wrong. So when I didn't see eggs immediately, you know, my brain's already thinking like she's unmated or she's poorly mated or she's sick or whatever. So going out to check on them again, after they've really had time to settle in, I was very nervous. But I am pleased to say that I went in and I found eggs and I found brood in all stages, you know, capped and then little tiny larva and bigger larva and so on. And I found my queen and she looks bigger now. So I don't know if it was just because she had been hungry from the long trip and she needed a little bit more time to recover. But yeah, she's laying now. I actually got to watch her lay an egg and it was really beautiful. And I loved the way the attendants were like rubbing, like gently touching her abdomen. And I don't know, it was just really cool to see. And I got a little teary eyed because I'm a huge softie and I was just so worried that it was going to be just a disaster in there. And it was such a relief to see a functional, healthy colony. They're also so calm right now. I mean, it's a good time of year in general for that sort of docility because we're going, you know, we're in a nectar flow. But yeah, they're so peaceful to watch. So that was really nice. They had all clustered up. You could see where they had clustered during this cold snap that we had. And kind of as a result, they were using just 5 frames in every box. So I checkerboarded, you know, I moved the used frames apart and put empty frames between them to encourage them to use all the frames. And then I added a honey super, which had some frames that needed to be built on, so they needed wax. And I gave them sugar syrup just as a little additional support to help them draw all that wax out. Depending on how much they've had of that syrup, I might remove it. I just need to check to see if they're actually using it or not. I just worry they're a little behind, so I want to make sure that they have everything that they need to be, you know, strong. Meanwhile, so while I'm sort of babying this package, my bee mentee, who I'll call Jay, had her colony swarm on her. And this is their second year beekeeping. They successfully got the colony through winter after having a really rough time. Jay and her husband are the ones who were unfortunate enough to experience Africanized honeybees, which is very unusual for this part of the US, and gave me my first experience with them as well, which I did not want to repeat. But we managed to get her requeened and everything before winter. So she gets them through winter and the colony had brood early on and was doing really, really well. And they've been in there every 7 to 10 days. So I was really surprised when she told me that they'd swarmed. Well, they were surprised too, because they're second years, but they're smart, they're committed, they do a lot of reading, they know what they're looking for. And it seems like it happened faster than you would expect. And I've been hearing stories from other local beekeepers that this year, a lot of colonies have swarmed so fast that by the time people noticed even one sign that swarming was going to happen, it was too late. We also might be reaching a record for swarms this spring. It seems like constantly everyone's colonies are swarming this year. So I don't know what's going on. I wish they could tell us, but my poor mentee basically could see the swarm. It went up into a tree near them, but it was way too high up for them to get. And they considered whether they wanted to call someone out to help them with it, but ultimately they decided to let them go and they just were going to split the remaining colony and requeen it with 2 queens that they picked up from a local supply place. They just did that. Things are going well. Apparently, even after splitting them, they are chock full of brood and honey. So I think that having a very slight brood break while these new queens get situated won't be a problem for them. And now they'll have 2 colonies, which is really what I recommend. I love having a colony I can take from if I need to help the other colony or to help me diagnose something. So I think this will be good. And I'm confident they're going to do really, really well this year. My neighbor's colonies continue to swarm almost every day, and he is becoming a little frantic asking people for help. Once I have my own gardens and hives and stuff sorted, I am going to try and go over and put a few hours in to see what I can do to help take the pressure off. It's kind of funny because he originally went from just asking for help, and then he was like, oh, if you help, I'll give you a discount on nukes. And now he's basically like, if you help, you can make your own nuke and take it home with you for free. I don't care. Just please come over and help. So, yeah, if I could, I would. But I just need a bit more time to sort my own shit out before I start like trying to unravel someone else's mess. So we'll see how that goes. But it's pretty funny. It feels like every day I get a text on our beekeeping chat about one of his colonies swarming. So sadly, so far, he keeps catching them. I'm really hoping I can lure one over, but we'll see. And that's really it for bees and chickens and traditional homesteady stuff. Kind of unrelated to everything, but important to me, is we just celebrated 5 years with Luna, my female whippet. So we adopted her 5 years ago. And I just love her so much. She's the best little snuggler. She loves to nap with me. She's always ready to nap. She is the laziest whippet in the whole world. And then I'm in the process of getting my greyhound Kaylee back to the special dentist in Columbus to have her remaining 6 teeth removed. So I've mentioned this before, but I'll do it again for any new listeners. Kaylee has something called CUPS, which is canine ulcerative paradental stomitis. And it's basically chronic inflammation of the gums. And they're not 100% what causes it, but it appears to be an immune disorder. So her immune system responds to the bacteria on her teeth by attacking the gums, and it causes, you know, inflammation, pain, ulcers. It's really unpleasant. And usually the only way to deal with it is to remove teeth. And for a lot of dogs, if you take half of the teeth out, that's enough. Well, she's had 2 surgeries. She had half of her teeth taken out the first time. It helped for a while, but then it started up again. So she had all but 6 teeth out, her 4 canines, because those are very deeply rooted into the jaw bones. So they're hard to remove and you risk cracking the jaw. And then just 2 incisors. Well, her mouth is a mess. Again, it looks really painful. She's still eating and she's still kind of a happy, bouncy, fluffy baby. But we know it's bothering her. So probably what we'll do is this dentist, what he does to deal with the canines is instead of pulling them, he basically does a root canal for all the canines and then he cuts them down to the gum level. And this seems to prevent inflammation from this disease. My friend had it done on her greyhound and he has no teeth now and he has no inflammation. I mean, his gums are just beautiful now. And he had CUPS reactions even worse than Kaylee. So I'm cautiously optimistic. I'm just a little nervous because she's going to be 11 next month. And I did speak with my vet about it and he said that, you know, she's in really good condition. We'll do the pre-surgery blood work with him first. And if anything comes up, then we'll postpone the surgery. But hopefully he's like, you know, with these kind of dogs, you just don't know. She could have a year left or she could have 5 years left. And with this level of discomfort and her current health, it seems like the best decision to do. I will definitely update when I have everything scheduled. But that's going to be a big enterprise. My husband is traveling a lot and I'll need someone to stay home with the whippets because I usually get up around, well, I'm out the door around 5 a.m. on the day of the surgeries because it's, you know, a good 2 hours to Columbus. And then I'm usually there all day and I don't get back until very late. So I need someone to look after my whippets. And with his travel plans for work, it's going to be a little bit of a juggle, but I think we'll get there. And because I can't mention my 2 pups without mentioning my 3rd puppy, Chaffee, my male whippet, has been really sweet for the last few days, like especially sweet. I think he knows that I've been super stressed out with our crazy schedules, and so he's been checking on me more, and he gives me more kisses, and he loves to snuggle under the blankets more whenever he can. It doesn't matter if it's kind of warm out, he wants to be under the blankets with Mama, and it's just so sweet, and I just love my dog so much. I'm definitely one of those sappy owners who looks at them and just cannot believe that I get to share my life with these like precious babies. So yeah, that's sort of the news here. I hope everyone listening is doing really, really well. I hope your hives are thriving and full of baby bees and everything's going great and the nectar is flowing and your chickens are happy and all the rest of it. I hope everything's glorious for you. And hopefully, barring anything else going wrong with the house, touch wood, I'll be back next week with news about the garden. I'm really hoping that the news will be everything is planted and now it's all about maintenance. I'll have news on the chicks. I will hopefully have news on the hive. And I might even have picked up my recently ordered nucleus colony by then. So maybe I'll have a little information on that installation. So as always, thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate you guys. And I hope you're doing well and you're staying safe. And I will be back in a week. So remember, as always, hug your hens and then wash your hands. Thank you so much for listening. Take care of yourselves. Bye.